Life continued for King Hezekiah. As the health crisis faded more and more into the past, the king went about his job, his business of being the king of Judah, sitting on David's throne in Jerusalem. Yet it is striking, is it not, that there's a much more material concerning the years before the health crisis than those that followed it, even though those years were one more than the years that came before. It's a striking observation just to make in passing. The knowledge that Hezekiah had only 15 years of life remaining did not make him indolent. You know, some people who would find out that they had only so much time remaining, they would start to spend all their resources to go here and there, or else just to be lazy. That was not Hezekiah. He continued to oversee the various concerns of his office. There were investments of the kingdom's wealth to manage, and a civil engineering project of such scope that its benefits continue in Jerusalem to this day. It was a time when the blessing of the Lord was upon the land and the people. The apostasy of the prior reign, the days of King Ahaz, became more remote as King Hezekiah continued to pursue his calling to lead the people in submission to the revelation of the word and will of God. Now, of course, Hezekiah had to be conscious of the race against the calendar. As you know, the years tend to melt away quickly. No doubt Hezekiah found such to be the case. His internal countdown clock reminded him that he had less and less time remaining and asserted itself in that reminder with greater urgency. There was much to do, and less time in which to do it. And over all of those concerns, the awareness of pending judgment on the king's compromise filled him with greater unease. He had no ability, he was aware, to forestall that judgment. He comforted himself that the devastation would not happen in his lifetime. Peace and truth would be in his days. But still, he could not help harboring the natural concern for how people would remember him, what his legacy would be in the generations that followed him. In spite of everything, however, all of these concerns, the last half of Hezekiah's reign brought to the kingdom and its people, we learn in the scriptures, a period of growth and increasing wealth. We could go back and read concerning the funeral of King Ahaz. That funeral was a bare concession to his status as a king of Judah. There was, for Ahaz, no elaborate ritual. The body of Ahaz did not join those of his predecessors in honored treatment and prestige by being buried in the tombs of the kings. Ahaz was not taken there. The impression that we get is that the people of Judah forgot Ahaz quickly and turned their attention instead to great expectation that Hezekiah would return the kingdom to something of its former glory. The efforts of the first half of the king's reign were a breath of fresh air in the land. There was spiritual awakening. And a return to that which remained of the legacy of Israel's great kings, David and Solomon. Now, there could be no approaching to the extent of that greatness, for Judah was a small kingdom. But the reign of Hezekiah, especially the second half of it, proved to be a period in which God blessed the king and the people in abundance, so that there was an echo, at least, of Solomon's time. If not any approximation to the lavish extent of Solomon's time. The words of this passage in 2 Chronicles 32 describe a period that every nation would desire. The kingdom was at peace. The world powers that were on the scene were either on the decline, as in the case of Assyria, or they were just beginning their ascendancy, as in the case of Babylon. There was no immediate threat then to Judah. So there was no draining of the nation's resources to defend its security. Instead, there was an extended period, as we read here, of what we call royal prosperity. Royal prosperity is our theme this evening. Now, it is safe to say that not very many, if any, of the subjects of the kingdom knew about the diplomatic mission that came from Babylon just after the king's recovery from his mortal illness. That is, the people had little awareness that the king had already compromised the kingdom's resources by making a display of them to the emissaries from Babylon, as we saw through his desire to be like the other kings of the world. All that most of the people in Judah knew was that life was good, and that there were no enemies at that time to threaten the peace and security of the nation. The siege by the Assyrians had ended in complete disaster for the Assyrians, and they were not coming back. So it was to be, in the history of Hezekiah's reign, the most fabulously successful period in the small kingdom's annals. It was to feature four aspects of prosperity that served to make that period a time of glowing happiness. First, economic expansion. The words at the outset of verse 27 pile up the report of the king's success. Not only did the king have riches and honor, that is, deference from his people and from those around him, but also he had much riches and honor. Not only did he have much riches and honor, but also he had exceeding much riches and honor. That's as far as the language can go in describing the extent of the king's wealth and of the kingdom's wealth. Now, there was no one still alive who could remember directly, or probably not even indirectly, the inordinate wealth of Solomon's reign. The standard of that reign was that silver was practically worthless. There was so much of it. It was nothing to be accounted of. Well, no one could remember that, but there would have been a few people, possibly, who studied something of the chronicles of that time. But most people, as you can appreciate, being the case today, could not bother themselves with that arcane history. For most people in Judah, there had been nothing like the booming economy that marked the second half of Hezekiah's time on the throne of David in Jerusalem. In verse 27, we find that the king had to order the construction of great treasuries in which to store and to admire the abundance of gold and silver and precious stones and spices and shields, defensive weapons, and pleasant jewels of every description. There was so much that he had to have new structures built in which to store these things. And there seemed to be more all the time. These expressions of which we read here included the array of weaponry that the king had at his disposal in the event of the need for military action that no one could foresee. But the words of the following verses also emphasize the increasing prosperity of the people at large, the prosperity of the kingdom in more practical ways. Agricultural harvests were abundant. There had to be new places built to store the tremendous harvests of corn and grapes and olives, grapes being used in the production of wine and olives in the production of oil. The king, we read, ordered more structures for the housing of animals, beasts of every various descriptions, birds, flocks. That is, it was a time of increasing abundance. And the king would have had to smile as he pondered the reality that on every hand, with every report that he received, he saw the evidence of bounty in the kingdom. And it appears as well that he realized the source of all the prosperity. And that's the second aspect of this prosperity, divine provision. For we read at the end of verse 29, God had given him substance very much. Now let us remember that when the Lord pronounced the coming of judgment that would affect the kingdom and Hezekiah's family in the generations after his, it was a promise that while Hezekiah lived and reigned, there would be peace and truth in his days. So God was fulfilling that promise. And the end of verse 29 underscored that fulfillment. God gave very much substance to the king and his subjects. And I think it's well for us to reflect on the fact that the prosperity of any people is not the result of their own ingenuity as much as it is the result of the blessing of God. Now, I think we should point out that there was a connection here between the blessing of God on the kingdom and the way in which King Hezekiah's policy urged the people to follow after the Lord, to observe the commandments of his holy word. There is a link between God's blessing upon the people and that policy of urging the people to go after the Lord. When people and nations do what is right, they do not earn the favor of God as though God is in their debt and has to pay them, but God blesses them in the midst of doing that which is right. It's a solemn reminder to every nation that casting aside the truth of God is the surest path to disaster. When you take the word of God and you pronounce it to be intolerable, an abomination, then the nation is on the road to disaster. And that's a solemn reminder as well to every individual. The economic expansion that the kingdom enjoyed and the time of peace and security in its international relations were both the result of the blessing of God. The wave of prosperity also offered a way in which the king could proceed practically to enhance Jerusalem's security and independence for future generations. And here we come to the third aspect of this prosperity: enduring engineering. Enduring engineering. Now, people of our time tend to think of anything to do with engineering as being completely foreign to the people of past centuries. But it is not the case. Because to this very day, and let us remember now that it is nearly, it's well over 2,500 years since Hezekiah reigned, there remains in existence, and not too many civil engineers could ever make this boast today, there remains in existence one of the most significant public works projects that any nation has ever undertaken in the world's history. During the last half of the 19th century, archaeologists uncovered the evidence of a massive civil engineering effort that dates to Hezekiah's time. Now, there have been infidels who have tried to call the date of the project into question so as to criticize the very record that is before us this evening in the scriptures. But there were teams of archaeologists who discovered an inscription in this project late in the 19th century, and the inscription leaves no doubt that the tunnel is the one that Hezekiah ordered to be built. So here is what Hezekiah wanted to do. The city of Jerusalem, and let us remember that in Hezekiah's time, it was just a fraction of the city of Jerusalem as it exists now. Very, very small slice of the area that now is Jerusalem. In his time, the main source of water for the city was the Gihon Spring. It was outside the city. It was on the slope that ascended above the Kidron Valley to the Mount of Olives. So in other words, to get water into the city, you had to go out to the spring and you had to retrieve the water there and bring it into the city. The king was sensitive to the fact, since they had already faced a siege by the Assyrians, that they were vulnerable if that situation were to continue. So the king gave the order that a diversion channel, what we read in 2 Kings 20, a conduit, a diversion channel, should change the course of the water's flow so as to prevent access to the water from its source. The channel, the conduit, the tunnel that he ordered to be built was to be effectively an underground aqueduct, an underground water supply line to bring the water from the Gihon spring directly underneath the walls of the city into the west side of the city of David, not nearly so far a distance to traverse as it would be to the west side of Jerusalem today. What Hezekiah did was order two teams of excavators to begin the project. Much like similar projects in later time, each team began working from one end of the proposed tunnel or conduit or channel. Now you can imagine that they didn't really have power machinery. So they dug the tunnel. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of yards here. They dug the tunnel through rock underneath Jerusalem, mainly with the use of pickaxes. So there would be a team of workers, and they would be using pickaxes, and then others would be carting out the rock and the dirt and the other debris. And they kept at it, meaning that they both had to know what the design was or they would not meet in the middle. Eventually, the two teams could hear each other and broke through. Now, the caliber of the engineering is a marvel to this day. For the design of Hezekiah to his engineers was for a tunnel that followed a gentle gradient that was steep enough to allow the water to flow downhill into a series of reservoirs inside Jerusalem, so that those inside the walls of the city could have access to the water, while those outside could not because of the way the flow of the water was diverted into this channel. There were a number of pools or reservoirs that came into existence. The main one came to be called Siloam. And that was a pool that was in use during the time when Jesus of Nazareth was walking in the world. Now, it was not the only project of this kind. But today, if you go to Jerusalem as a tourist, in some of the tours, you are able actually to walk through the calf or knee-high water in Hezekiah's tunnel. At the end of verse 30, we find that there were a number of projects of this nature. We read there that Hezekiah prospered in all his works. So the design, you can appreciate, was to keep the water away from any assaulting force that would try to gain entrance to the city, and at the same time to preserve the water so that the residents of the city could use it. And the water coming from a spring, the idea was that the water would always be there. The funds for the project, which you can imagine were substantial, were the result of the blessing of God on the kingdom in the economic expansion of which we have read. But over everything, even over these great projects, as we have said, was the growing awareness that judgment was in the offing. And that brings us to the fourth aspect of this prosperity, exposing testing. In spite of everything that we have read in these verses, and they are brief verses, really, in spite of everything, there was still on the record that incident of which we have already spoken. In verse 31, howbeit, Hezekiah prospered in all his works. We read at the end of verse 30. In verse 31, howbeit, there was something tempering everything. Howbeit, in the business of the ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, who sent unto him to inquire of the wonder that was done in the land. We learn in verse 31 that at that time God left him for a time. Left him to his own opinions, to his own devices, to his own decisions, as a means, we read, of testing him. And what was the purpose of the testing? We read here in verse 31 that he might know all that was in his heart. Now let us ask the question, did God not know already all that was in the heart of Hezekiah? Obviously he did. But he wanted the king to know. He wanted the king to know. And so he left him for a time so that Hezekiah would understand that apart from dependence on the Lord, not even all the prosperity of the kingdom would avail for him. Our testing times are to expose what is within us, not for God's information, for he already knows, but for our instruction and admonition. God already knows what we are. He already knows what is there. In those times of testing, the response of our hearts ought to be not to rely upon our own designs and our own industry, but to call on the Lord so that his grace and his mercy will sustain us, will preserve us against our own folly. How many times we are brought to a point where our own folly leads us and guides us into foolish decisions. God left him to test him, that he might know all that was in his heart. And in that manner, God tests us, not so that we may become failures and flops, but so that we may learn what it means not to trust to our own resources, to our own reasoning, but to trust in the one who is our God and who has said to us again and again, I will never leave you or forsake you. It was a time of royal prosperity in the last half of Hezekiah's reign. And yet, as we've observed, the amount of space given to describing that period is very small compared to what took place before. Here was the indication that God was blessing the people, but still there was overshadowing it all, that failure by Hezekiah to seek after the Lord and to follow the Lord with all his heart. We remember that it was said of Caleb, just reading this again recently, it was said of Caleb, when the spies went into the land of Israel to spy out the land, it was said of Caleb on that occasion that he wholly followed the Lord, not trusting to what appeared to him or to anyone else to be the situation, but that he wholly followed the Lord. And the Lord pronounced a great blessing upon Caleb for following the Lord, not relying upon his own wisdom. So the Lord has promised to bless his people. Let us then be found wholly following the Lord and always skeptical of that which is at our own disposal. Let us rest on the Lord then for his direction, for his grace and his mercy in our lives.